I'm disappointed in people on our side.
Okay.
For being hypocrites about sexual harassers and abusers of women who are in our party, who are sitting in the White House, who brag about their extramarital affairs, who brag about mistreating women. And because he happens to have an R after his name, we look the other way, we don't complain. Sure. You cannot claim that you stand for women.
Not true. Not true.
And put up with that.
Welcome to the Femsplainers. I'm Danielle Crittenden.
And I'm Christina Hoff Summers. And this episode of the Femsplainers, in fact, all of the shows being recorded here at the AEI Ricochet Podcast Summit, graciously hosted by our friends at the American Enterprise Institute. It's sponsored by Donors Trust, the Community Foundation for Liberty.
And Christina, if you care about limited government, personal responsibility, and free enterprise, Donors Trust is the charitable partner to choose. Learn how Donors Trust can help you at donorstrust.org/ricochet. So let's get into it.
Yes. And no booing anyone.
No booing, because we're excited to have as our guest Mona Charon, who was the woman getting booed at CPAC by other Republican women. And yeah, no booing today. Thank you very much. Mona is a best-selling author, a syndicated columnist, senior fellow at the Ethics of Public Policy Center, and her new book, Sex Matters, will be published in June, and we'll have you back on to talk about that.
Looking forward.
But the first question I want to ask you is, how disorienting was it for you to be booed by Republican women? Could you have imagined that happening, say, 4 years ago?
Well, when you grow up as a conservative in a liberal environment, as I did, you know, was raised in New Jersey and went to college in New York City, I already had great practice in being in the minority and knew what it felt like to be unpopular, to have unpopular points of view. So maybe that was a little bit of inoculation. Obviously, the crowd at CPAC was quite hostile, but I think it's important to say that while I was booed by a significant percentage of the audience, I would say it was about 60-40. There were at least 40%, hard to do with exact measure. Mm-hmm. There were at least 40% of the people in the audience who were applauding and mm-hmm. who were giving me the thumbs up. But yeah, it was interesting.
And what do you think they objected to most that you were saying?
So in our tribalized world, my impression was that these are people who have gotten their news exclusively from conservative sites and genuinely and righteously believed that, for example, when I cited Roy Moore, righteously believed that these were all lies, that it was not true, and that he had been railroaded and he had been maligned. And so they were standing up for what they saw as a persecuted conservative. In fact, when I also mentioned Marine Le Pen, who is the French ex-politician, niece of Marine Le Pen, who had also been invited to the CPAC conference, I heard people in the audience, when I said that she was a member of the National Front and therefore not a conservative, people called out from the audience, "No, she's a conservative." So they are so ready to believe that anyone that the left has a bad word for is innocent. And so that was the sort of tribal response.
In the video, which we'll put up on our website, because, of course, if you're listening to this, you can't see it. But when we were putting that together, I was very struck how almost perfectly bookmarked the whole sequence of events between
you
Bill
did a
Clinton.
Good job on that video. That was just amazing.
Thank you. And I'm going to plug my daughter, Miranda Frum, who is way more better at this stuff than I am.
Did I understand correctly? Did Kathleen Willey say,
yes,
defend Trump?
After
and say,
he brought the accusers, Trump brought the accusers to the Hillary, one of the debates.
Yeah.
And he had a press conference with them before the debate and was sort of trolling Bill Clinton in the audience by having them sit up front
right.
of the debate.
Right.
But I was very struck by the sort of bookmarked comparisons that we saw in the sequence of these events. So I want to go back a little, and maybe not everyone here will remember it, but we saw this kind of hypocrisy amongst feminists who supported Bill Clinton at the time.
And how?
Oh, my.
What is going on? What is going on?
Back in the 90s, Gloria Steinem famously had a... Gloria Steinem famously wrote an op-ed in the New York Times explaining why what Bill Clinton did with Monica Lewinsky was not a problem. It was consensual, she said, and that was
It was called the feminist one free pass.
Yeah, essentially one free grope, whatever. Anyway, because it was somebody that they regarded as an important figure on their side, and because they felt that he was a staunch abortion, they were right, he was a staunch abortion supporter, that they would excuse this gross and despicable conduct toward women, and specifically in this case toward this was as classic a case of sexual harassment in the workplace as you could possibly imagine.
Wait, Lewinsky?
Lewinsky, she was 22 or 23. He was the president of the United States.
I would say it was bad judgment. I'm not sure it was consensual.
It was consensual, but according to the feminist definition of sexual harassment, the unequal power situation here meant that her consent is irrelevant because he was so much more powerful. So by their logic, it was a classic sexual harassment situation.
Right, and this is why Republicans at the time were going nuts, because this was sort of, what do I want to call it, the second wave of feminism, when we had Andrea Dworkin. That was the moment where men were getting fired for making inappropriate jokes by the water cooler. So while this was taking place and the women's movement was advocating that men be punished for these comparatively seemingly minor infractions, the head of the government is having fun in the Oval Office.
They had been full bore arrayed against Senator Bob Packwood.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Bob Packwood done? Oh, kissed some people in elevators.
He seemed like that really drunk, gross guy at the party.
Very gross. Actually, he came over to me and put his hands on my shoulders after this whole controversy had already blown up. It was amazing. Some people are just uneducable. But in any event.
Or you're just that irresistible, Mother.
Yeah, that was it. but that was in the 90s, late 80s and 90s, and then they flipped 180 degrees because it was a politician on their side and same thing. So if there's anything that's going to encourage cynicism among young people, it's seeing that the parties don't have any real principles, that
it's
feminists don't have any.
It's tribal.
Totally tribal, which is one of the reasons I felt it was important when I was at CPAC, say, you know what, we have an obligation to police our own side, and if more people did that, we'd have a healthier civil society.
I have a question to ask about our own video. But Mona has to answer. So in the end, we are saying, you're kind of mocking women standing by their man. And I think that's the woman's choice. And I think that infidelity might be different, or maybe you don't agree, different from a criminal predation, sexual predation or harassment. But do you think that, if you go back, there are quite a few presidents, I don't want to say more than not, but quite a few going back to Jefferson through, I certainly know, was it Harding and LBJ? LBJ used to be insulted if someone talked about John F. Kennedy's sexual conquest. He would snap the table, this according to his biographer, Donald, snap the table and say, I've had more women by accident than LBJ had on purpose. And, this was the way it was. So lots of infidelity.
Okay, can I interrupt with a quick story about LBJ, though?
Yeah.
Because that was just the way he was. I mean, he was so competitive with Everett Dirksen, who was the Republican minority leader at the time. So they were constantly trying to one-up each other. And Johnson got a car phone installed in his limo that took him back and forth. And so Everett Dirksen was very envious about this, and finally, after many years, arranged to get his own phone installed in the minority leader's car. So the first thing he did when Everett Dirksen got his phone was he picks it up and he says, call Lyndon Johnson. Calls Lyndon Johnson. Hello? Lyndon, it's Ev. Oh, hi, Ev. Guess where I'm calling you from? He says, Ev, can you hold on? My other line is ringing.
The sad thing is we remember that technology. I guess what Christina is asking is, should we care if the president is having a discreet affair? And that's really not the issue at stake today. I mean, we should be so lucky they're having a discreet affair. We're talking about predatory behavior. And what you're referencing, Mona, is an era. I mean, you would talk about women like deer you'd bagged or notches on your belt. And Kennedy, by any standard today, would be considered a predator. And the press.
Both.
All of them.
Well, I have a response.
You have a Kennedy story?
No.
but the only difference was back then, editors of the Washington Post were banging their secretaries. So they were all in it together and keeping it quiet.
So there is something to be said for hypocrisy. The things that Johnson and Kennedy were doing, the things that Jefferson may or may not have done, probably did, were not public. And if they had been, they would have destroyed all of them.
But they were concealed. They weren't public only because the largely dominated male press would not cover it.
Well, that is true, which is a separate question. But the fact is, so if a standard has become so denigrated that nobody even cares whether it's upheld in public, I think that's a slide down to social decay beyond simply having people misbehave in private. Because now what we've said since Clinton is, yeah, not only is he a dog, but we don't care because morality doesn't matter. Private morality, public morality, none of it matters. All that matters is, you know, my paycheck is bigger or, you know, he's for abortion, you know. And I think that is a problem in our society, just in terms of upholding any standards at all about moral behavior. So one of the things in that Gloria Steinem piece, again, where she talked about the consent, she never once mentions that Bill Clinton was married. And that by that standard alone, for him to be carrying on an extramarital affair was immoral. And another aspect of his betrayal, right? And so I'm not so quick to say, yes, it's always gone on, because if it's public, it's different.
You can have a messy private life and still be effective publicly. And I in defense of voters, and including feminist voters, maybe they just make a judgment that the candidate is far from perfect, but and it seems to me the American people love to read about, you know, sexual peccadilloes and so forth. But when it comes to voting, they tend to vote on the issues that they care about.
Well, who knows what people vote on?
Who knows?
I mean, it's really hard to tell. But what we have seen with your little video is the degree to which over the past 25 years, American politics has just become entertainment. I mean, it's the show, and we're watching this newest episode, and we can't wait to see what season two of Trump the President is going to contain.
It won't happen because we'll all have been detonated by now.
You know, people say it's important that we know about the sex lives of political candidates because they're, you know, position of importance. But by that argument, there are a lot of people, maybe we should know about the sex lives of reporters. Because,
Oh my gosh.
Well, I guess
Cardinal Richelieu here.
So first of all, during the Me Too movement, we've had a lot of that.
Exactly.
And that I don't think has necessarily been a bad thing.
Right.
I'm glad that these malefactors are being brought
being outed.
Yes.
Can I just say, because I'm gonna argue with you a bit. Good. Me Too, in a way, I don't think it's just a degradation of morality because Me Too, in a way, is restoring a sense of morality.
I agree with
say
that. Yeah.
That we are not accepting this. And it's one thing to say, well, people can, they'll have their private lives. People do have their private lives. I'm sure there are many dozens of affairs going on right now that are discreet that we don't know about. But when a president, I mean, right now we're debating whether it's the public's business if Russian oligarchs are paying off a president's mistress.
Exactly.
And that's kind of in the interest of the public to know.
Exactly. I mean, I was just going to add also that you have to add in, you know, financial corruption.
Right.
You need to know if somebody in a position of power like the president is vulnerable to blackmail. It can be blackmailed. And there's evidence to think that that might be a serious problem in this presidency. We will see. But there are some disturbing indications that the president might actually have been, like in that story about Broidy, the RNC mm-hmm. guy, who admitted to having paid off a Playboy actress for $1.6 million, somebody that Broidy supposedly impregnated and urged to have an abortion. And the lawyer who handled this whole transaction was Michael Cohen. There's a theory going around, and it just hasn't been proved, but that it was actually Trump.
Maybe by the time this podcast airs.
Maybe. It's just, if that's the case, it means the layers of corruption are just phenomenal, because what it suggests is that Broidy, in order to gain Trump's acquiescence on a deal that he wanted to do in Malaysia, and therefore used his position with Trump and the favor he was doing to Trump by taking the blame for this affair, he got something out of it because he brought Trump, he brought this Malaysian together with Trump, and it was worth multi-millions of dollars to Broidy. I think we'd call that at the bare minimum swampy.
Well, it's not often we're in front of a live audience, and we have, do we have 15 minutes or 30 minutes still? Looks like, oh, we can keep going. We've got more time. All right, sorry, Christina, go ahead. I wanted to make sure we have at least 15 minutes. If anybody would like to ask questions.
Did you tell them about our cocktails?
Oh, yes. It's part of our brand, really, that we have cocktails when we podcast. And so at Mona's request, we're having Bloody Marys, because it is only 11 in the morning, even.
It was too early, okay.
Too early for me, so I have a mimosa.
Yeah, you're not a Bloody
Mary. It's really just orange juice. Anyway, cheers.
Cheers.
I guess there's part of me, I just have scandal fatigue, and I can't keep track of it all. And I wish that we could make distinctions. And like, for example, with the Me Too movement, it's absolutely horrifying what we just learned about the Attorney General of New York. And that gives me, reminds me of the seriousness in the Me Too movement, why we need it, and women are emboldened now to come out and tell about these monsters. However, at this, in the same time, there was an incident where a man, Professor LeBeau, it was accused of sexual harassment because he made a little joke about lingerie in an elevator. And we have some, now a writer, Juno Diaz, I don't know, minor transgressions. And so there's a kind of quietly going on, this almost purging the every domain of transgressors. But transgression is being defined so broadly that even making a little joke, he was in an elevator at an academic conference in the Hilton Hotel, and there was a gender scholar, a feminist scholar there. No humor allowed. He said, they were going up, and he said, what floor do you want? And he said, lingerie, please. You know, it was an old joke.
Ladies' lingerie.
And
as opposed to men's lingerie.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, these days.
Yeah.
I think, maybe he was transgressive and wanted lingerie for himself, and she was being judgmental.
So. Maybe, yeah.
Anyway, my point is, and I do have one. Where do we draw the line? Yeah, about that?
This is the role, I think, that the unique contribution for conservative women in this whole debate. Because
conservative
women keep their heads and acknowledge that, you know, the Me Too movement is, on the whole, a very good thing. And I will note that a lot of the men who have been accused have not denied the accusations. I mean, they've just basically said, yeah, I did that. So the idea that this is some sort of huge net that's dragging in a lot of innocent men, I don't think has actually been the case. On the other hand, you're right. There are these instances where people get carried away. And I think the Aziz Ansari case was one where, you know, obviously this woman had a very bad experience, but she conflated her bad sexual experience with Aziz Ansari, a man she had pursued and gone to his apartment and had sex with, and later felt like it wasn't really pleasant for her, and she felt a little coerced and whatever. Things, by the way, that women feel a lot of the time in this new wonderful sexual paradise that we've created with the sexual revolution. But in any event, for her to write a piece about Aziz Ansari and suggest that somehow, you know, this was a form of sexual assault was really way too far.
And it really damaged the Me Too movement in many people's eyes, because she publicly humiliated him for no reason. And then a lot of women, I've seen polls, their confidence in this Me Too movement diminished. So we have to be careful. And I agree so much that it's conservative women who aren't captive to this narrative of, you know, that American society is a patriarchal, oppressive male hegemony. No, but there are some men, especially it seems high-profile men working in unusual environments, you know, who took full advantage, and now they are on notice. They're not going to get away with it.
Well, I'm going to say something even more optimistic, that this excess of political correctness and what you describe on campuses, both of you do so well, maybe what has been hopeful and impressive about the Me Too movement is the cases are very egregious. I mean, as someone has said, it's like a witch hunt, except all the witches are guilty.
Yeah.
And in a way, it may be a kind of rotor-rooting way to eliminate these excesses, to make people suddenly realize, no, this is what we're talking about, not I didn't appreciate your elevator joke.
The sexual harassment, from the point of view of a woman of a certain age, that is me, I think has gotten worse over the my lifetime.
I thought you were going to say we miss it. It ends, darlings. It all ends.
Yes.
But really, when I was in college, you know, and professors were chasing me around desks, it was all absolutely G-rated compared to, like, the Harvey Weinstein stories that you hear now.
Right.
I mean, about him masturbating into a potted plant in a restaurant in front of this woman and you know.
Come on, that's kind of exciting. You've got to
admit. Yeah, that's a real turn-on. Or the fact, you know, and the other thing I worry about, and I will do a little shameless plug for my book, which is coming out next month, Sex Matters. That would be June 26th, Sex Matters. You can pre-order on Amazon anyway. But I think the problem with so many young women is, it's not their fault, mind you, but our society has denied to young women the tools to keep men's lust at bay. They've told them that if they're not into it, that there's something wrong with them, that they need to lighten up, why aren't they sex positive, and so on. And so they don't really know where the lines are. And so all of these stories that you read, you know, where these young women in a business environment are going for business meetings to men in their hotel rooms. We women should be saying to them, don't do that.
Bit of a red flag.
It's not done. There's never a reason for you to go to some guy's hotel room for a business meeting. And young women should be given those tools and know that it's perfectly okay for them to say no, and that men who try to do that should be shamed.
I was just thinking, there are young women that want to go to there's cooperation, and that young women have, and you're not supposed to say this, but I'm just thinking that young women have a certain power of youth and beauty, and which they consciously might use for their advantage, and you do have consensual mutual exploitation.
We've talked a lot about this. This is something we talk a lot about on the Femsplainer podcast, and it's what is sort of startling to what you're saying, Mona. It's the kind of, I don't know, both combination of obvious naivete and, as the Aziz Ansari date showed, you're on a first date with a man and the first thing you do when you get into his apartment is drop to your knees. Where, you know, why is that going on? Since when did that, I mean, I've joked that sex used to be the culmination of a relationship. It was the thing you worked towards, the ultimate consummation of intimacy. And now that is completely eliminated. And women, having had a glass of wine they didn't even want, apparently, according to the date.
She didn't like the wine.
Nonetheless, she did feel that she ought to do this.
Yes. Listen.
And then regret it.
The rules that govern sexual behavior these days, obviously there are a lot of subcultures in American society that abide by different rules. And, you know, if you're part of a religious community, you don't behave this way and so forth. But, you know, I talk to a lot of kids on college campuses for my book, and, you know, the expectation is that it's sex first, relationship later, if at all.
Right.
And that is a system that could have been designed by 14-year-old boys. Right? I mean, it's definitely not in the interests of women.
I read yesterday there was a young woman at Cornell University, and for reasons I don't quite understand, she had to give a formal presentation, and the teacher had suggested that you dress in a businesslike way, and she felt that was oppressive and patriarchal.
Yes.
So in protest, this young woman took off her clothes, well, except for her bra and panties, and gave her presentation to overthrow the patriarchy. And I'm thinking, you know, that's one thing the patriarchy might support.
Even better if it had been a bikini.
Well said, yes.
But, Christine, I think what you were trying to say, and I tease you about
being a bit of a bad girl, which I might have gone home with Aziz Ansari and not complained about it.
And well, okay. I mean, I might have told my girlfriends, but I mean, you never mind.
All right, we'll move on. But what we're denying, I think what you're saying is also you don't want to infantilize women and say that they don't have individual agency in these. And it's sort of a combo. On the one hand, you're saying men have these crazy expectations, but women want to behave like porn stars. But then if they do and they don't enjoy it, they're victimized.
It sometimes sounds like we're going back to the Victorian age of fair maidens and constantly put upon by men. And I call it fainting couch feminism because it's popular on the campus.
Except now they don't just faint.
I like fainting couch feminism. I think that's good. I think women need to be more upfront about their vulnerability because they are more vulnerable sexually than men and always will be. And no matter how liberated we are,
we still have the babies.
We have the babies. Also, there's lots and lots of evidence, both anecdotal and scientific, that women become more attached to people that they have sex with than men. They release the hormone oxytocin. There's a well-known phenomenon, I'm sure you guys are familiar with it, where a woman who didn't have any particularly strong feelings about a guy sleeps with him and suddenly is like hanging by the phone waiting for him to call her. Why? Her brain went into oxytocin mode, and now she's ferociously attached to a guy that she really didn't care that much about beforehand. That happens. It doesn't always happen, but it does happen to women more. By the way, men release oxytocin too, just not nearly as much.
And they get it over the counter, don't they?
It's been tried, actually, because...
Can I get somewhere?
But actually, you know, I know the feminists get teased a lot for being, you know, neo-Victorians, and I've done that myself. But honestly, when you look around the culture that we've got now, it's so raw, it's so degraded, it's so gross. A little bit of Victorianism wouldn't go amiss right now.
Certainly in the White House.
You know, it's funny, when I look at the campus, I don't see what you're describing. Is I see empowered young women, and increasingly in charge. And I talked to young men, and in one case, some guys were telling me that the girls are almost the ones that have to make the move because it's so risky. Now, I'm talking about these elite campuses, but there's great fear in the minds of young men. So do you think that's a good thing, or this is what we should have?
No. I don't want the sexes to be at war, and I don't want them to be scared of one another. I want to bring back dating, you know, that we make a conscious effort to help young people navigate this very awkward stage of life by teaching them how to date again.
You mean beyond swipe left or right?
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's a myth about dating. They dated in the 50s. By the 60s, you date again when you're older. But I don't know. There's in college and so forth, you sort of hang out.
So
did you date in college?
I did. I dated in college.
She got chased around the desk.
Some of the women that I spoke to, and Hannah Rosen had a piece in the Atlantic magazine where she quoted one of these like high-powered grad students, the kind that you describe as being in charge, as confessing that, you know, actually what she would really like is just some guy to ask her out on a date to the frozen yogurt place. She said, that's it, a $3 date. That's what I want.
We're going to go to questions, but I did have actually just one more question I want to ask Mona to put these things in perspective. You worked in the Reagan White House. You worked for Nancy Reagan, and then I think you moved into speechwriting?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What and public affairs.
How do you react to the news of what's coming out of this White House and the eruptions? Can you imagine that ever happening under the Reagan White House? Did you see stuff that just didn't come out?
The Reagan White House was like a military machine. I mean, it worked like clockwork, and it was just everything was planned, and they had a news event of the day that was going to dominate all the news, and they had it, you know, wired. It was incredibly efficient. There were fights inside about which way to go, and there were ideological battles within the staff. But in terms of
stars,
but no porn stars.
As far as I know, there were no. Well, there was Ollie North. I don't know. Does that count?
Please join the Femsplainers. Yes, subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your favorite podcast hangout.
And follow us on Instagram at the Femsplainer Podcast.
And find the Femsplainers on Facebook and Twitter at Femsplainers.
And learn all about us at Femsplainers.com.
Thank you. Yeah, Femsplainer.
All right, so maybe we can take it to questions. We have 14 minutes.
Honorary mansplainer.
Honorary mansplainer. Can you tell us who you are?
Oh, I'm Matt Schoenfeld. So appreciate it. So I saw that clip from CPAC, and I was kind of disturbed by it too. I guess my follow-up then is, and I agree that Trump's of questionable character, and that really bothers me, and I spend a lot of time talking to my friends about it. Some of them make excuses for it. Some of them are like me that find it disgusting. But what do we do about it? What's the next step? What do you want done? What do you want to see? Do you want to see Trump resign over it? I mean, what's the recourse?
I just want conservatives and all people of conscience to simply not cover for it, to simply not make excuses for it, to not say, as one of the religious leaders said in a book about Trump, well, you know, when he was chasing all those women, he was really searching for God.
We have high opinions of ourselves.
So I just want people to be honest. If I have no idea why it is that so many people on the right have agreed to Trump's terms, which are that you have to be a groveling, you know, sycophant in order to be in his good books. Why can they not say, you know, we really liked what you did on this or that or taxes, whatever it might be. This other thing, you know, the porn stars and the behavior and the lying and the personal vendettas and all of that, we think is disgusting. I don't understand why people can't just do that. Just tell the truth.
Especially when, as we were saying earlier, when these sex scandals can be tied to serious corruption and blackmail and potential.
Possibly, yes.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Kelsey Harkness. I'm with the Daily Signal. I was actually on that CPAC.
Oh, yeah. Kelsey,
right now.
Kelsey, you were the one going. I couldn't, of course, I'm not this technologically able, but I want to put a balloon over your head on that video because you were like, oh no, she's going there. Mona's going there.
Well, the topic was never asked, so Mona just brought it up. And so it kind of came from nowhere, and I saw people draw all sorts of conclusions based on my body language. And all I can tell you is I just didn't know that was happening. It was like a bomb dropped on the panel, and I tried to hold myself together. But I don't know if you saw what I followed up and said on Twitter, but I defended you, and I'm glad you said that on stage. And I do think it's a conversation we need to have as conservative women. And that was going to be my question. So many of conservative women don't defend him and defend his behavior, but we also care about things like tax reform. So where do you draw the line? Do you want us to be joining the resistance because of this? But that question was just asked. So my follow-up is, for all of you, really, do you think the Me Too conversation would be as relevant in our culture today had it not been for Trump's behavior?
His election. I don't think we'd even have a Me Too movement. I think he galvanized the movement because of people were so frustrated by the indifference towards his, you know, the grab him by the pussy and everything else.
Also, I have to put in a word here, and thanks for being here. I have to put in a word for the liberal media here. I know that's, you know, this is probably not the audience to do it, but look, Ronan Farrow and Jane Mayer published that piece in The New Yorker about Eric Schneiderman, a big Democrat, a thorn in Trump's side. They also revealed the depredations of Harvey Weinstein. The Democratic senators did team up and ask Al Franken to step aside. So at last, in fits and starts,
they are holding their side
accountable.
I don't put him in the same category.
No, he's not in the same category. I'm just saying they were willing to go after one of their own, even though
some
it was against
them.
Their interests. Yeah,
I
right.
think, Kelsey, though, you're right, because this is one of the things that I would look to Donald Trump and say, thank you, Mr. President, you are making America great again, because it is the as you saw, and I wanted to run a little more of that clip on the bus. It was so abhorrent. And to have this kind of language and behavior condoned in a man who became president of the United States, I think that was part of the wake-up call for women, and women of all politics. Like, what is, I think, very heartening about the Me Too women movement is it's brought so many women who used to be arguing with each other or debating each other together. And then, of course, you know, thanks to Ronan Farrow at The New Yorker, then the Weinstein story broke. So yes, in a way you could look at this as this kind of perverse gift that we received from the president.
Yes.
I hope that women can unite on this and not go to their corners and say, well, we will criticize Al Franken if we're conservatives, and, you know, we'll criticize Harvey Weinstein, but we'll be quiet about Trump and about Roy Moore, and vis-a-vis the other side, same thing. They'll only criticize Trump and Moore and so forth. So if there's a little bit of breaking of that ice, that would be fantastic, and I think it would be good for women and good for our entire culture.
Yeah, that would be an amazing thing if the Trump presidency led to a real renegotiation of the social contract, in that men and women will just go to a new stage.
A new enlightenment.
And of yes. Yeah. And true, you know, mutual respect.
Do we have
all
any
right, this
has
other
gotten questions? Too optimistic.
It's gotten
too serious. Whoa. Have another drink, ladies.
Yeah, let's have a drink.
Do we have any other questions?
First, I want to say I listened to your first one, and you guys are awesome. I subscribed immediately.
Thank you.
This kind of begs the question to me. We're talking about the fact that, you know, watching Trump have this behavior kind of made women go, okay, enough, we're going to speak up. Why is it that the Me Too movement didn't happen when it was Clinton?
Ah, good question. Because many think that the Clinton escapades actually stopped a movement that was already going on sexual harassment, starting with Anita Hill, and there was a lot of momentum, and then it was Bill Clinton, and it set women back years because we had to wait for Donald Trump to come along to remind us.
Mm-hmm. You could also say Bill Clinton paved the way for Me Too. Like, I wonder if the reaction would have been as strong if we had not had the Clinton scandal too.
Yeah.
I wonder if liberals will ever grapple with the reality that the taint of Clinton is what elected Donald Trump, right? I mean, mm-hmm. There is practically nobody else that would have lost that election except Hillary Clinton. And she lost because she was such a sewer of corruption herself.
Well, also, no, remember her, and women didn't like her, and one of the reasons they did not like her was because she was putting out campaign ads saying, we need to listen to women.
Oh, yes.
We need to believe women. Believe women.
Exactly. What?
She was told by some of her younger advisors that she wasn't resonating with younger women, and so she became a believe all women, you know, social justice activist.
Yeah, it's just hilarious.
But you know what I'm thinking too?
She was in charge of trashing all the women who accused her husband.
Let's say one more thing, is that societies do make progress. And you look back now in movies that I hadn't really thought about, might have enjoyed, and you go back and now with this Me Too awareness, and you think, oh my goodness, that, you know, that really was a sexual violation. But now you go back and look at Ted Kennedy, mm-hmm. the lion of the Senate, and, you know, idolized by Democrats. Mm-hmm. And part of me thinks that we have to go, I don't want to go back and, you know, reappraise every human being based on this new awareness, because it's a kind of presentism that's going to lead to chaos. But isn't it amazing that when you think of the Mary Jo Kopechne story and how we... it was just absorbed, and we moved on, and no one, well, not, you know, not that no one held it against him, but his party really didn't.
His party didn't, exactly. I mean, it was a big deal on the right, and there were bumper stickers like, you know, after Three Mile Island, you know, more people have died in Ted Kennedy's car than died at Three Mile Island. So conservatives never forgot it.
Yeah.
But yeah, the left had its own level of corruption. And that's why I mentioned earlier that they are now taking on at least some of their own. And this is a positive thing that we should encourage, even as we do the same thing.
Right. It's an argument for holding your party responsible for its actions.
Exactly.
Thanks for being here. I have a question, a slightly different topic, but as conservative women, I'm curious your experience. I get a lot of, if you're a conservative woman, it's you don't understand your own self-interest. Michelle Obama said something similar about when Trump got elected. And I get it all the time. It makes my blood boil. I'm just curious your experience with it.
Are you a Trump supporter? Is this where what context do these comments arise?
It's actually mostly, I think, on the abortion debate. Is you don't understand your if you would vote Democrat if you understood your own self-interest as a woman. And I think it's putting like identity politics as a woman.
So you can only be a woman if you're a Democrat. And, yeah, and I mean, this is said by the Pope of women, who gets to decide who is a woman and who is not.
Yeah.
Whenever I have been asked this question about abortion, I've always said, look, I am for women. I'm for women's rights, for women's welfare. And it begins at the moment of conception and goes all the way to natural death. So all of those women babies who are being aborted, they have my support. And that is something that the feminists cannot say. And I actually, I have a whole chapter in my book about abortion. I think that they discredited themselves as a movement very much by making taking innocent life the marquee issue of their movement. And it alienated, even though we might have agreed on many issues about women's rights, women's welfare, equity. Christine always talks about equity feminism. By the way, I quote you constantly in the book.
Okay, that's so good.
But we might have agreed on all that. But then when they said, no, you have to believe in killing the unborn, otherwise you're not a real feminist, it just alienated a lot of us.
And so unnecessarily, and I say this as someone who is pro-choice, but I understand and respect women who have a different point of view. And I understand the arguments, and it's just I've made a different decision. But as Mona says, in the sort of organized women's movement, conservative women, especially on the choice issue, have been isolated. And at the Women's March, they were officially disinvited. And now other groups are sort of in limbo, like Jewish women or in women that support Israel that don't come out well on this intersectional pyramid. So I would say that the fact that the women's movement, what we know historically is that when conservative and liberal women work together, it happened in the 18th century, and then again the suffrage movement was a coming together of sort of more radical, liberal, left-wing feminists, I guess you could call them, and then it was the Christian Temperance Union with Frances Willard, conservative women, religious women, that's when women make the most progress. Even in this second wave of feminism, the golden age of feminism was actually, and feminist historians admit this, was the late 60s, early 70s, and it was an achievement of Republican and Democratic women and a lot of men. Mm-hmm. The parties worked together. At one point, the ERA was a bipartisan issue. It was only when feminist groups came in and imposed a strange agenda. It wasn't Phyllis Schlafly. Phyllis Schlafly was able to do what she did because of the way the sort of some extreme feminists had interpreted it in ways that were very discouraging for a majority of voters.
Well, and I would say this is important. I'm going to be the Pollyanna again of the Me Too movement and the women's marches, because why should we let them push us out, right? That this is a moment for all of us to support these issues that we agree on, speak out, and don't let them push you out of it. And that's what's so great about this moment and why I'm very hopeful. But our time, the little clock went off. I just wanted to thank AEI Ricochet for having us at this podcast summit. Thank you all for attending. Thank you, Mona. Thank my sister, Christina.
Thank you. And listen to the Femsplainers.
Subscribe now.